Hey everyone, and as usual, thanks for tuning in. Before we get into the episode, we know it's been a while. Finding timeframes that work for everyone can be quite the challenge, and you also have to run a company with more than 100 people. However, we can see our listener numbers in our analytics, and that really makes it worth every time. So thank you so much for sticking around and continuing to tune in to the stories we work hard to show. It's a pleasure and a privilege to get to do this. Our podcast also had a big influence on an article I wrote during my time in the Silicon Valley this month. It's about the Earth Observation Ecosystem, and it's called An Investor's Guide to Earth Observation. It was even recommended by the former NASA administrator Dan Golden and many more people. So check out the link in the description if you want to read it. But now about this episode. This one features the CEO of a tech-spec startup that has just started to roll out demos of its logistics software used for building satellites. But before this, he was an army officer managing millions of dollars of its equipment. So how did he end up in space? The answer is actually a bit shocking. One note, unfortunately, the guest audio has some issues around the first 15 minutes and is later fixed. We hope you understand and it doesn't affect your listening experience. Our podcast producer, Gabriel, tried his best to keep everything understandable. Enough from me. Thanks again and enjoy the episode. Hello and welcome to the New Space Vision podcast sponsored by LiveView, where we discuss new space technology, finance, and innovation with executives, founders, and more exciting people from the startup and new space ecosystem. I'm Daniel Seidel.
And I'm Sam Shivara, and together we are the founders of the Earth observation company LiveView and New Space Vision. Today we are very excited to welcome Yuk Chi Chan, founder and CEO of Charter Space, which wants to optimize the way how people build and launch satellites through software. Welcome.
Thanks, Daniel Sven. Thanks for having me. It's lovely to be here.
Cool. Well, great. I'm very excited about this podcast because I read a little bit about what you do and what you've done in the past. But maybe could you introduce yourself real quick for our audience? Who are you and what do you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm Yuk Chi. I'm the founder and CEO of Charter. We develop engineering operations and program management software for teams building spacecraft and other complex systems. So the essential idea is that a lot of time right now is wasted on manual admin by engineering teams who are building complex systems like spacecrafts. A lot of that time is spent on emails and spreadsheets and generating reports and documentation. And all this stuff really is just a distraction away from the actual substantive work that matters, which is, you know, building, integrating, testing, and launching spacecraft. Because of that, this inefficiency manifests in terms of very real costs, but also introduces new risk factors into the mission process caused by human oversight and human error. We want to solve that. We want to cut down the time that's wasted, as well as improve safety and reliability and traceability of artifacts and documentation. And so we built a platform to essentially enable that. My own background, I come from a logistics and engineering background. And so this was very close to my heart in my previous role as mission manager. Also because, you know, this used to be my job and I did not like the fact that I didn't have any appropriate tools that I could actually rely on. So I set out to go build a company that basically builds the software that I would have used.
Yeah, so that's what I would say. Not an idea you wake up in the morning and you say, oh, I will do this. It's more like multiple years of pain and designing space hardware, right? So can you tell us a bit how you ended up in space and what else you did before?
Yeah, absolutely. My transition in space has been very recent. I used to be what they call a ground pounder. So I started my career as an army officer in the Singapore Army. And I was a battalion logistics officer for an engineering unit. And we handled maintenance and recovery operations of armored and tracked vehicles, which is a very convoluted way of saying I fix tanks. I manage guys who fix tanks. And so I got to do that at a very high level, which was a very great honor and great privilege. Because, you know, where else on earth are you going to find a 21-year-old who is responsible for a $100 million technology portfolio? But that's what I got to do. I got to work at the battalion brigade level, as well as at the army and joint services level. So I got to coordinate with other branches of service to ensure that the armored corps was rolling. And so a lot of that job was really logistics and operations at a distance, right? Working with engineers and technicians who were both in base as well as forward deployed in the field, and coordinating, orchestrating a lot of different moving parts, where, you know, time was of the essence, safety was a major factor, cost was a major factor. And so we really had to get it right every single time, because if we didn't, that ruined lives. And so I got to do that for a while. It was a great job. Really enjoyed it. Got to play with a lot of fun stuff. But I unfortunately saw too many industrial accidents while I was in the service to want to do it anymore. So after I left the service, I actually went to law school. Traded in the wrench and spanner for pen and keyboard. But while I was in law school, I actually specialized in space law. And so I specialized in small sat regulation, as well as overall debris mitigation policy, and general sort of space sustainability. And, you know, I got to do a little bit on the policy side and as well as the research side. So on the policy side, I advised government of Uganda on their draft space policy and national space legislation. I led a UN-backed study to examine adoption of UN guidelines across 20 or so jurisdictions, and then I presented that the results of that study in a report to the UN in a speech. I stood up the space law practice at my old firm, and I technically still lecture at my old university on space law whenever I manage to get up there, because it's a 3-hour train journey from London, and it's not exactly the most convenient place to get to. But every time I'm up there, I try to make an effort to give a visiting lecture. And then on the research side, I got to publish, I got to present at conferences, you know, all the good stuff. And then those two skill sets really came together when I got recruited for a satellite propulsion company to be their mission manager. And the essential idea there was, you know, they wanted somebody who could do the operations aspect and who had experience working with engineers and had that background pulling together complex engineering campaigns, but at the same time could also do the compliance part, because, you know, this was during the era when UOPs was really starting to come into its own, and it made a lot of sense given how heavily regulated space is that you would want somebody who could do the operations piece as well as compliance piece, and you can meld the two things together. That's how I ended up in space.
Okay, but now you're the CEO of Charter Space, but there was an important element in between, right? The idea from Charter Space stemmed from your work in another company which you co-founded, if I understand correctly.
Yes. Co-founded was, well, we subscribed to the whole Y Combinator model of, if you're early enough, you know, we want to have equal equity split and we give everybody title equity. I got recruited a little bit later in that company's lifespan. But yeah, it was called Anchor. It was an interesting concept. So we were developing a station-keeping device based around electrodynamic tether technology. And the idea was that you would use the electrodynamic tether essentially as a propulsion unit to station keep in very low Earth orbit. And so the idea was, there are a few commercial companies right now looking at very low Earth orbit operations. Of course, ESA with their Gucci mission a few years ago proved that you could have a host of technical benefits from operating in VLEO. And so we wanted to enable companies to really capitalize on that. The fact that it is closer to Earth means that you have significantly improved signal-to-noise ratio, lower power draw, better latency, but also it was more environmentally responsible because the atmospheric drag is exponentially higher the lower you go. And so the specific orbit range, altitude range that we were targeting was to enable operations between 250 and 300 kilometers in altitude, wherein, you know, if a spacecraft became inoperative, it would get deorbited within a couple of weeks rather than months or years. And so that's how we viewed it as being, you know, both being commercially viable as well as environmentally responsible. And that's what we really wanted to build. We want to build these tether-based propulsion units to enable people to orbit lower.
Mm-hmm. But the company, in the end, is the company still existing?
No, unfortunately, it wasn't. It shut down. There were a host of issues relating to EDT tech. I don't know how familiar you guys are with EDTs, but they were originally pioneered in the 70s, I believe, by JPL. And it's a very elegant concept. The way that we were employing it, essentially we have a long wire, long conducted wire that you drape off of the end of the satellite. And it's held taut by the gravity gradient, and you run a current through it, and then you orbit it in an equatorial orbit such that this electrified wire cuts across the Earth's magnetic field lines, generates a Lorentz force. not enough thrust to orbit change, but just enough to correct for orbital decay. And so, you know, it was the perfect device for station heating. The problem is, most tethers are pretty long. The initial version one design that we came up with was about 500 meters long, which you can imagine is a little bit of a collision risk. Fairly large cross-sectional area. And also, you know, one of the big reasons why tethers hadn't really been expanded upon commercially before this was launch cost. You know, tethers are intrinsically very, very difficult to work with. One of the big challenges that we were able to surmount was the actual mechanical deployment of the tether. But, you know, back in the day, that wasn't really feasible. Very often the tether would jam and you would basically have sent up this, you know, large spacecraft tether and it'd be useless. So we thought that we would be able to surmount that given that launch costs were cheaper. But between a mix of the safety factor as well as the fact that it's really, really difficult to engineer, we encountered a host of other issues that we weren't able to iterate fast enough to solve.
Yeah.
And then,
I just wanted to say, that's right, the startup, right? But it's really interesting when I've read that about on your CV, because I had also, and when I studied in my bachelor, I also thought around, hey, why hasn't really any, wasn't there any commercial deployment of tether technology for station keeping? So I was also playing around with that idea to potentially write a bachelor or master thesis around it. But yeah, one of the issues exactly back then, which I read up, was exactly the difficult deployment of that the tether. Super cool. But sorry, Danny, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, exactly. From a timing perspective, also electric propulsion was just coming up in the past years, right? I think that was also something not in the favor of the tether technology. But yeah, I mean, let's see. Maybe it comes back, right? Maybe there are some missions where it makes sense. Do you know others still working on it?
Others still working on it. I do recall a couple of years back, there was a team out of India that was looking at multi-tether propulsion concept. I'm not really sure what happened to them, because I think they were a research team out of university, not a commercial outfit. So I'm not really sure what's happened to them. But I know that people are still looking into tethers. And I think ultimately tethers are such a deceptively elegant concept that I think people continue looking at them. They're quite neat, right? So why not? But I'm not aware of any other companies that are working on tethers specifically. I know that Tethers Unlimited got acquired by Emergent a few years back, and they were the last ones that I really remember working on tethers besides us.
Okay, good. That was a quick deep dive into tether technology, but obviously we are here today to not speak about tethers, but about charter space. So can you tell us a little bit about charter space? And if I'm an engineer, how would you pitch the company to me? Why should I use it?
Well, if you're an engineer, the pitch actually becomes a lot simpler. Do you hate Excel? Do you hate managing requirements in Excel? Do you hate managing projects in Jira? Do you hate having to transfer information between your Jira and your Excel and your emails and, you know, all the other different like mediums in which you capture information? Well, we do that. We have one platform where all the information is captured natively directly on the web app. You never need to tangle with all these other mediums. It's all just there and it's all built specifically for you. That's the pitch.
Cool. Nice. That sounds great. Especially if you use all the tools which you've just mentioned.
Go for it.
No, I was just going to say that ultimately, one of the things that we built Charter to be is we built it for teams that are building things, right? It is, it's not an engineering platform by any stretch of the imagination. It does have some engineering type features and it is built for systems engineers, but ultimately it's an operations platform. It takes over the moment you are done with you've arrived at your first initial stable design, your system, and now you need to actually put the meat to the metal and you need to actually build the thing. It is for that long gap in between the moment you decide what you want to build and the moment that what you've built actually goes up. I think it's one of those areas that really very easily gets overlooked unless you've actually built hardware before or unless you've actually had to go through that journey before. Because in an academic tabletop setting, It's just, oh yeah, we've designed it and then it goes up and then we figure out what happens after that. And I think there's a lot of focus on Uber operations, rightfully so, but operations do exist on the ground as well. And building a system, a complex system like a spacecraft, is not as simple as snapping your fingers and blinking your eyes.
So where do you start and where do you stop in the process of designing satellites and operating satellites?
So we actually don't handle any of the design. Now, you can technically use us for design, but we're not optimized for it. Where we really start is after you've completed your initial PBR and you've settled on a stable design, you know exactly what you want to build. There is, of course, some room for iteration, some room for further trade studies down the line, assuming that requirements change or supply chain disruption means that you can't get all the parts that you need or, life happens, right? Mm-hmm. But it starts the second you have that stable design, and we carry on all the way for the build, integrate, test, and iterate process to the moment your spacecraft is actually integrated into the launch vehicle and goes up. Now we do a little bit of stuff at the post launch on orbit phase. We maintain everything as a full system of record. So if you encounter any faults on orbit and you need to perform root cause analysis for corrective action, you can come back to us and everything is fully logged. We have full traceability, so you can really decompose everything all the way back to the original root cause. You can find any anomalies that took place throughout your program. It's all captured, and then you can begin to troubleshoot. But it's not as active of a role. We're just there. If nothing goes wrong when you're in orbit, which is rare, but I hear sometimes it happens. If nothing goes wrong, then you never have to interact with us again. But if you do, we've captured everything for you. That's essentially where we live in the life cycle.
Yeah, and I've looked at your website and it's obviously super impressive. Maybe, may I ask, when did you start with the company exactly and how long have you been around?
So, we've been around since early November 2021. So the way that the company actually got started was in the waning days of Anchor, as we were sort of encountering a lot of issues. So for context, we were housed out of the National Propulsion Test Facility here in the UK. So it's a place called Westcott in Buckinghamshire. And that's essentially, that's where all propulsion-based activities and propulsion-based test facilities, it's got the most comprehensive set of propulsion-based test facilities in the country. And so we were encountering a lot of issues with our program, and it was just a deeply frustrating experience for me as mission manager, because I was just trying to move the needle forward. I was just trying to get us to actually build the things that we needed to build. But at every other juncture, something was getting overlooked, or some documentation wasn't being submitted, or something was slipping through the cracks. And so I got really, really annoyed by how much information leakage there was. And so I had in my mind the idea for Charter, this idea of a single, unified, fully integrated platform into which everything plugged in. It's a single source of truth, but it's also not just a static repository, right? It's almost like we would have given the company a second brain that everybody can interact with and be capable of pushing changes out to the edge, after the individual engineer who's in the clean room. And I had this idea in my mind, and I was thinking to myself, okay, well, I haven't encountered anything like this so far, but it can't be that this thing doesn't exist. And so I reached out to a bunch of fellow mission managers in the industry who are all working on live programs. And I just sat them down, I interviewed them, and I asked them, teach me what you're doing, right? Tell me what tools you're using. How are you currently managing this process? And they would go, we're using the exact same things you're using. We're doing the exact same things you're doing. We're complaining about the exact same things you're complaining about. There isn't really anything to be done here. And so I would sit across from these guys as I was interviewing them. I would hear them complain, and I would pitch to them, okay, what do you think about this? And I would pitch them the essential idea of what Charter would become, right? And they would go, yeah, this is fantastic. Are you building this thing? Please tell me you're building this thing. I will pay you money for this thing. By the time I got to six or seven interviews, I realized, okay, well, I should probably go build this company now, because if not, I've promised this product to six or seven people, And if I don't follow through, they're going to be really, really pissed off. So that was roughly around October 2021. I got a little bit of encouragement from some friends to actually take the big leap and go, you know, strike it out on my own. And yeah, I think Charter has been going ever since.
Very cool.
And you also raced around a pre-seed round, right? And 2022, which
yes.
So congrats to that.
Thank you. It's been an interesting time fundraising during this. So during this era where, you know, we see the end of the, we actually started fundraising right as the market started to go south, and you know, right as the zero interest rate bubble started to pop. So yeah, it's been really interesting. I feel like I've learned decades worth of lessons in a year.
I can imagine.
Yeah, I think that I can double it. Yeah, exactly. And maybe just like one question is obviously what you've described is great, and you've already mentioned there are people which have an interest in that product, right? Mm-hmm. Who are your typical customers? So you've mentioned mission managers, but like who are your typical customers?
So in terms of the institution itself, it's any company or organization that builds spacecraft or other types of complex systems that have to operate in challenging environments where there is a very low margin of error. Meaning to say, you know, you can't mess up, you can't perform corrective maintenance. Once the system is out there, it's out there and it has to work on the first try. So that's obviously fairly large scope. It's most applicable, I think, to space, but there are other context in which it might make sense. So potentially with hypersonics, hypersonic weapons, as well as hypersonic vehicles, anything to do with maritime less so, but you know, particularly in terms of deep sea where corrective maintenance is a little bit harder to perform, where it's harder to get to the system itself. Very applicable. We started a space because we know space best, but as we've gone along and we've interacted with more kinds of companies and more kinds of customers, it's become immediately apparent that there are more use cases to this. The challenge then becomes product focus and product vision and how far down each rabbit hole do we want to veer? Because, you know, space is obviously a very unique and interesting industry, but it actually has a lot more in common with other complex engineering fields than we might think. But yeah, so in terms of the actual customer, anybody who builds spacecraft, right? Anybody who builds things that need to go up and stay up there. And in terms of the actual people using us, we envision primarily program managers, mission managers, people like me who have to sort of sit there and perform an orchestration type function to coordinate between a bunch of different other people. But there's a place for everybody on our platform. Anybody who is materially able to contribute to or detract from the success of a mission. So engineers, but also, you know, regulatory officers or finance people or HR and resourcing or inventory managers. Anybody who is going to touch the hardware at some point or do something that has an impact on the hardware, they're all relevant on our platform.
Yeah, that's super, super exciting. I mean, looking back, it's now around about 2 years, right? You mentioned October 2021. Mm-hmm. I could also see a lot of logos on your website, which is very impressive, right? A lot of big names, you can see that. When did you launch the first version of your product to a real user out there? How long did it take you?
Let's see. So we've worked with users from day one as design pilots. So a lot of those companies or a lot of those mission managers that I interviewed at the very start, one of the first things that we did was we brought them on to interview them and essentially conduct intense user research with them to understand what their actual needs and requirements were. And so we've undergone multiple rounds of design pilots. The first time a live version of our platform was actually in a user's hands was earlier this year. So mid-May. Mid-May was when we launched our private beta to a handful of trusted partners and companies. Since then, they've been using us. The platform has matured significantly since mid-May. I think that was the first time somebody actually got their hands on our code.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that it's a lot of complexity in building such a software, right? And But I like also your approach here, like from user interviews from day one, right? That's the right approach. Is there any user you can talk about which you are really 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 proud of, or is this still too early to say?
Yeah, no. So I think there's one that we are that we are very, very proud of, that I think I'm able to talk about at this point. Obviously, without I need to walk my words very carefully to represent the relationship accurately. But NASA Jet Propulsion Lab. So we've been piloting with one of their teams since the very start of this year. We announced that partnership last year during Tesla's demo day, but this year we've gotten actually started in earnest. And as of 2 weeks ago, we are live with them in the field, supporting something that you would not see in a regular sort of spacecraft manufacturing context, because they are out on a glacier in Canada, literally in the field.
Nice.
Yeah, it sounds really interesting. I really have to say that what Daniel pointed to, that you have a lot of features on your website which all in itself look very complex to develop, right? From like chat functionalities to time axes, I can see there are block diagrams to exactly modulation of certain parameters on one side of the platform, and it rolls back into the others. Exactly, it's so much functionality. The question is for me is like, how do you price it? Like, what's the business model behind it? Exactly, are people do people have to unlock features? Hey, you can't use the timeline view. You have to pay an extra for that. How does it work?
So it is a very bog standard SaaS model. So we charge per user, and then we bundle together tiers for organizations. So the base price per seat is $4,200 per user per year, and then it scales up. Of course, if you have more seats, we give you bulk discounts. But the way that we actually price the additional features, so everything that you see on the platform right now, all of those basic features to enable any team to build, they're all available at the base tier. Where we get more complex as you upgrade tiers and you unlock additional functionality. All that additional functionality has to do with the fact that your team is growing, and so you would need more complex organizational management type features, right? So you'd need to be able to see across different teams. You'd be able to unlock system of systems functionality at higher tiers, as well as other things that we would peg to sort of a larger organization. So at the second tier, what we call the growth tier, which costs about $100,000 for up to 25 users. We also provide GovCloud deployment natively. So it's included as part of the package. You don't have to pay anything extra for it. And the thesis behind that is, you know, a company that is of that size may potentially start working with the US government. They may start going after government contracts that would require them to have deployment on GovCloud or to store all their information on GovCloud. So that's the way that we've actually priced the additional features. If you are a scrappy student team and you just want to launch your CubeSat at ISS or whatever, you get a unique tier just for you. All educational institutions and research institutions, as well as actually companies that have raised less than $2 million in venture funding throughout their lifetimes, because you know every dollar matters at that point. But for smaller companies and universities, it's $1,000 per user per year. It's a flat price, and it scales up to however many users you want. And every single thing that you see on the platform, on the website, is available from day one. It only gets more complex once you get more complex, so we can grow with our users.
Yeah, that sounds exciting. I mean, there are a lot of software players which have like free licenses for universities, and then people actually learn their master in that software. Mm-hmm. So maybe in, that's also a good one for you.
Oh yeah, there's the Orbital SDK model.
Exactly. Yeah. So do you know? I mean, you know how much people are spending. That's your pricing. But on the other side, I assume it's very hard to quantify the return of investment for the users, right? So how do you do that? And what is your typically pitch? Your sales pitch? How much money customers can use, or how much time they can use?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. In terms of value-based pricing and this sort of productivity software, it's always hard to actually peg it to, you know, you can't really say, oh, we're helping you save this much time or this much dollars, because that's never something that companies, generally that we found customers to be willing to accept right off the bat.
But in terms of the way that we, so the way that we phrase the value, it's really about what we enable rather than what we save for them. So of course, there are the cost savings. Based on our own research, we estimate that, 60% of each engineer's time daily is wasted on admin tasks. And that's unfortunately a massive number. And that's actually an average across a bunch of different, something like 200 user interviews that we've conducted across all five major customer segments that we're looking at, which is smaller customers, enterprises, civil government, military, as well as intelligence. So across those five segments, we've come to an average figure of 60%. Now we can say that we will help you save 60% of your time, and that time can be redeployed towards more useful things, which is obviously very, very good for any sort of P&L leader who is looking at improving efficiency and cutting cost. But we prefer to phrase it as what we enable. How much faster can they go? How much more work can they get done? How much can they cut down their lead times by, and how many more contracts can they pursue because they are that much more responsive? So we view it in terms of, instead of just being able to save 60% of your time, you are also able to deploy 40% faster. You are able to build spacecraft 40% faster. You're able to churn out and hit targets this much more reliably because you have that much extra slack in your operations now. You are able to run that much faster, and therefore, even if you encounter inevitable delays, the impact is no longer as great. So there's three kinds of angles. It's the risk mitigation, it's the cost cutting, but also it's also how much extra can you get done.
That totally makes sense, yeah. So from what we hear from you, it's there is a big problem. It's a validated problem, right? You now have a product in the market. VCs have seen it in the first round. Now, what about the competitive landscape? Mm-hmm. Because you said there is nothing existing like that yet. So do you see a lot of movement there? Or do you still think you can be in the pole position?
So I think we're the first in a potential wave. And I think this really has to do with the way that the industry has grown over the last 10 years. If we cast our minds back 30 years to the early 90s, end of the Cold War, right around the start of the first commercial space boom, a lot of the people that were coming into the commercial space industry were trained at the space agencies, right? Both NASA as well as Roscosmos before that went down. And so they brought a lot of that big agency mindset with them. And it was still fine at the time because we were looking at massive 1-2 ton buses that were going to GEO, where you could afford to sink 10 years and billions of dollars into one singular system, because one, that system was immensely complex and also immensely expensive. And so it would be safer for you to sink more time into it and ensure that nothing was missed rather than taking shortcuts and potentially having a multi-billion dollar explosion on your hands. Then the commercial space race, the first one sort of petered out, the telco bust came, and then we saw space get a little bit quiet for 20 years. And then come 2015, of course, Falcon 9 lands for the first time successfully. And we start seeing this shift in architecture in terms of the way that satellites are constructed as well as the way that operations are architected. So a shift from big buses to small buses deployed in constellation. That means more hardware, more discrete systems going out the door at higher clip, higher operational tempo. At the same time, you also see, and I think this is what Planet really proved, that you didn't require this highly bespoke bus. You could strap a smartphone. You could strap a smartphone to a satellite bus and send it up, and it would perform just as well. And so we start seeing this small sat revolution, this shift towards smaller architectures. Smaller and distributed architectures. And then at the same time, you also see a change in contracting models with government. So a shift away from cost plus to firm fixed pricing means that efficiency is now a lot more important because you can't just bill the government for your overruns. Every extra dollar that you spend comes out of your margin. And so this shift in terms of contracting as well as the spacecraft and the hardware itself then means that you start seeing a lot more moving parts, a lot more things that have to be built on a shorter timeline, and you cannot afford any overruns. And this all means that coordination orchestration becomes that much more important. At the same time, the sort of modus operandi that came out of the earlier era of the space race is no longer as applicable, because you have a lot more people coming into the industry now who may not have come from the space agencies, right? They're now coming in from all walks of life. And so it's all of a sudden the neighborhood's getting a lot bigger. I can't just look up inside the NASA directory, Bill from, building 327, because I don't know who's in building 327 anymore. There isn't a building 327. And so that model of communications and interpersonal interaction, when it starts to scale up, breaks, because you no longer know who's on the other end of the line. It's more difficult to coordinate and orchestrate. So it's a combination of all those things that I think has created the situation and created the conditions right for companies like us, that help with that coordination, help with that orchestration, and ultimately enable the industry to work a lot more effectively with each other.
Yeah.
So I think we're the first in a wave. I don't think we'll be the last. But I think right now it is a fairly blue ocean opportunity. And I'm only thankful that I am here in the right place and the right time to take advantage of that.
Cool. Yeah. There's a lot of transition going on in general project management software, right? Jira has been around, mm-hmm. and obviously there Monday.com and Asana, which have a more lean, slick interface and are adding functionality to it. And I think we see something similar happening here in the aerospace industry. Another big trend, obviously, apart from that, has been, LLMs and generative AI. The question, obviously, or what a lot of VCs also say, and also people which are just interested in technology, is that LLMs will have a fundamental impact on how we interact with software or with information at large. Did you already had any thoughts around how to, or are you already implementing LLMs into your software? Because if you have a lot of data, you obviously want to make sure that everyone has the best access to the information within this data. So any thoughts on that?
Yes. without getting too in-depth and giving away our competitive advantage for things that we have planned coming down the line, we actually do have a number of machine learning engineers on our team who've been with machine learning for the last 10 years, and they've been in the space for the last 10 years. It just so happened that they came aboard, and then this whole thing with LLMs started exploding, and we started seeing a lot more functionality. But ultimately, I think there's the problem is still data. One, in terms of really nailing the problem that we're trying to solve, because I don't think LLMs are a magic, cure-all. I think that they are a specific tool that have to be implemented to solve specific problems. So then the question becomes, how do you frame the problem statement, and how do you go about gathering the data to address that very narrow problem? I'm part of the camp that doesn't necessarily believe that machine learning is the pathway to AGI, because I still view it as, I subscribe to the Gary Marcus school of thought on machine learning and sort of the third wave of AI, which is that, this is very, very smart, narrow AI that can solve very, very narrow problems, but ultimately is not necessarily generalizable. I could be wrong, right? Because I don't have any formal training in AI. I'm just an enthusiast. That's the opinion of our team so far as well, that, LLMs are excellent narrow tools. So problem definition becomes very, very important. And then data gathering. And I think space introduces an additional challenge, because this is something that we've heard from interacting with some of the primes and some customers in our pipeline who have, shall we say, much more sensitive work on their plates. They're not comfortable with that data being shared in any sense. Even if it is completely harmless, it's just a general policy of data sanitation and data discipline. And so gathering the data to solve the problem, even after we've defined the problem, is going to be a challenge. I'm not necessarily convinced by anybody who says that they are able to deploy anything AI-related in space right now, at least insofar as project management is concerned.
One fun fact about the space is I asked, you mentioned the drag coefficient in the low Earth atmosphere, right? Yep. I asked ChatGPT a while ago because I just wanted to test how good it is at this physics thing. It told me the drag coefficient of a car, which is completely wrong. So just, you know, I think the training material for the space specifics is also like very limited, right? But Sven, yeah, you want to follow up?
No, in fact, I think maybe it's now time to transition a little bit outside of what you already said, YC, right? We started speaking more about the ecosystem at large. So exactly, let's maybe transition to speaking a little bit about the ecosystem, Daniel.
That makes sense, because Sven and I, of course, when we started the company back then, when we started New Space Vision, we wanted to understand what's happening because we think it's a historic inflection point, right? And I was just in Paris last week talking to a lot of people from the ecosystem, and it's definitely it's incredible, all this activity on all aspects. And you are now, I would say, in the center, right? Because your customers are actually the companies which are evolving on the hardware side and are building this incredible infrastructure. So we would be curious just how you see the market evolving and all these new players coming up.
So I have swung wildly from pole to pole, just based on who I've interacted with and all the things that I've gotten to see and hear. I used to believe that consolidation was inevitable. I no longer really believe that. I think there is a good chance that consolidation can be avoided, and we can avoid the same sort of slowdown and big freeze that we saw during the last big commercial space boom at the end of the 90s. But I think there's a few key conditions that have to be satisfied if we want to avoid consolidation, because otherwise we're going to see large roll-ups in the exact same way. I think the first thing is going to be regular access to space, not just from the launch provider perspective, mind you, but I think in terms of improving supply chains such that lead times are cut down, because this is ultimately one of the other issues that we want to solve. If a space company doesn't have their assets in orbit, they're not making money. They are constantly bleeding operational expenses because, payroll still needs to go out, utilities still need to go out, rent still needs to go out. And so the sooner they can get to orbit and they can cut, and the more reliably they can cut down those lead times, the better their chances of surviving. And I think this is all fairly, conventional wisdom. But when I say access to space, it's not just about launch. I know that there is obviously a massive backlog in launch right now, and there is massive demand to launch. But everything earlier than that matters as well. So access to sort of regular supply chains or components, subsystems, access to test facilities, all these things have to be addressed. And in order, the only real way we can do that is by investing in the infrastructure. If I step off of the self-interested podium for a little bit, because obviously we also consider ourselves as being part of that core infrastructure that has to be invested into. But ultimately, I think that there is abundant talent and there is abundant capital. The problem is it's not currently being deployed in the right amounts, in the right areas, with the right timing. And that's three variables right there. It's already very challenging to manage. So what I would think, the second thing that I think needs to happen in addition to access to launch becoming better or access to space becoming better is in terms of institutional capital that's made available, I do think there needs to be significant education that's affected. There needs to be more investors getting into space, and they need as a whole to better understand the environment that, we are not talking about, we're not talking about just regular hardware here, right? Because regular hardware can be iterated on, it can be quickly iterated on, you can hold it and you can see it and you can touch it, it becomes real. Whereas with space, it's a little bit more distant. So I'm from Singapore, and, Singapore isn't exactly known for space activity, even though I think Singapore has about 20 satellites in orbit as a whole. But taking Singapore as an example, I think space appears particularly distant to us. And so, Singapore is known as being one of the wealthiest nations on the planet, but it really doesn't invest all that much into space. And so A big part of that is the education aspect. The fact that it's just not something that comes up in daily life. It's not something that most people think of. When they think of the modern economy, they don't think about the fact that high-frequency trading is enabled by satellite communications, or that weather services are enabled by Earth observation. So these are things that are second, third, fourth order concerns to them. First, I think in order to avoid consolidation, we need to have better access to space. But also, second, there needs to be more smart capital entering the market. It can't necessarily be 100% government-led, I think, because the government is... It's a big organization. Inevitably, it will never have all of its priorities and incentives 100% aligned. The government isn't a monolith. And so I do think there needs to be a significant introduction of private capital. And then the third thing, in order to avoid consolidation, is actually in service of the first two things, which is that I think space companies need to get better at communicating. I know that I'm guilty of this because I go off on tangents. But I do think that space companies and people in the space industry need to make it more accessible and get people excited, right? It can't just be pictures of James Webb. It needs to be something that's more relatable, something that actually connects to each and every single person. I think if we fail to achieve these three things, then I think consolidation is inevitable. But the good news is I think we are at a crucial point in the life cycle, in this current market cycle, where we could break tradition and we could actually send, instead of the circle repeating itself, we could veer off and achieve a much more diverse market that maybe will slow down and then we will return to consolidation. But at the very least, we will be a lot more diverse than in that scenario than if we completely give up now and we allow the consolidation to happen.
Yeah, maybe last and second to last question, quick one. What launch or event in the space industry are you looking forward the most? Which might happen over the next couple of years?
I'm looking forward to the first commercial space station.
Nice.
Now, whichever one that is indeterminate, but I'm excited to see the first one go up because I think that will be the moment where I think for the average person, they will start realizing that commercial space isn't just a billionaire's playground, which is ironic because, Orbital Reef is obviously... belongs to Blue Origin. But I think that will be the moment where the fact really will come home that commercial companies aren't just on the periphery in space. They are the space industry. They are core to the space industry. And commercial companies are able to achieve a great deal of things. I think one of the most inspiring stories out of the 90s was with Bigelow Aerospace and their inflatable module on the ISS. Unfortunately, nobody knows about this thing, but it's awesome. It's a great story, right? And I do wish more people knew about it. I think the first commercial space station will achieve that en masse.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm also looking forward to this because like a few years ago before LifeView, I investigated a hardware idea and I wanted to understand how can I launch an experiment on ISS? And I mean, like every astronaut minute counts, right? And I think... also, the focus of the International Space Station, like the scientific purpose, is very important. That's why it was built for. But there are so many commercial applications, which you could actually test in orbit. So I'm looking forward to these ones.
Yeah. Nice. Last question: who should we have next on the podcast?
You guys got to talk to my buddy. His name is Olushan Taiwo. He is the co-founder and CEO of I believe the company's new name is Solidion. He is the first man in America to launch something 3D printed to space. So he was one of the earliest employees at Rocket Lab USA, as well as Virgin Orbit, back when Virgin Orbit was still going strong. And he was responsible for 3D printing all the core engine components for Virgin Orbit's first successful launch. He gets to hold the title of first man in America to launch something 3D printed to space. And I think the most exciting thing is that he is actually younger than I am by about 3 weeks. I've done nothing nearly as impressive as what he's done. So you guys should definitely talk to him.
So yeah, thanks a lot for joining us today. And I learned, right, Yuk-Chi, it's actually a YC, like the Y Combinator, right? So thanks YC for joining us. And make sure you follow Yuk also, YC also on the links we share below the podcast on the social media. And thanks, listeners, for tuning in. It was very exciting to talk to you, and see you in the next episode.
Thank you, Daniel, Sven, for having me.
Thank you.
All right, lift off, and the clock is started.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff.